The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Hypertension is presented by Dr. John Pryor.
We all know that it's very common. It's 30% of the population. As we get older, it's even more common. It's the most common risk factor for cardiovascular disease. When they look at even in the world, it's the most common, it's a risk factor for death and disease-adjusted life years. So it's a very common thing. And what they've always found is we don't control it that well. But despite the fact that we don't control it that well, if you look at what's happened in the past 30 to 40 years, we've actually improved outcomes just by our partial control. So one, as we get older, we're more likely to have hypertension, whether we be a man or a woman. Two, certain races seem to have a higher incidence. So blacks, especially West African black, tend to have a higher incidence of hypertension. And also remember I told you the apolipoprotein 1 mutation that seems to lead to worse hypertension and more likely incidence of chronic kidney disease as well. So definitions. So you should know these definitions and we'll go through them quickly. So primary hypertension just says there's no demonstrated secondary cause. My pressure is more than 130 over 90. They now have a category called elevated blood pressure. My pressure is between 120 and 129 over, and my systolic blood pressure is more than 80. That's called elevated blood pressure. So that's a sort of a warning sign. Say, we ought to look at this person. We should talk to them about risk factor modifications. Maybe they have hypertension. Maybe they don't. I don't know. White coat hypertension is pressures above 140 over 90 in the office, but at home it's good. Masked hypertension is the opposite. So they come and see you, their blood pressure is normal in your office, but yet they have LVH and proteinuria, and you say, geez, they must have hypertension that I can't find. Secondary hypertension is there's a cause. Malignant hypertension is a very specific diagnosis. So it's elevated blood pressure. It doesn't matter which level it is. And they have to have grade 3 or grade 4 hypertensive eyes, which I'm going to show you what that means. And they can have a thrombotic microangiopathy as part of it, which can cause organ system dysfunction every place else. Resistant hypertension is now a patient that's above goal on 3 drugs, one of which is a diuretic. Or a patient on 4 drugs and controlled is considered to be resistant hypertension now. That's an important distinction just because these are the people that have a higher instance of secondary hypertension that you need to work up. So this is the Keith and Wagner classification of acute hypertension. So if you remember, it's focal spasm, diffuse spasm, hemorrhages and exudates, and papilledema. So this is a person who has papilledema, and they have a hemorrhage there. So this is grade 3 and grade 4 eyes. So if you have those eyes, plus you have hypertension, I don't care what it is, what the blood pressure is, this is malignant hypertension. So that group of people, you look for people. So those are the people that get acute kidney injury from hypertension. Those are the people that get encephalopathy and PRESS from hypertension. Those are the people that get organ system dysfunction from hypertension. Used to have a woman that every other month she would come in with acute pancreatitis from a thrombotic microangiopathy from her hypertension. And she had malignant nigrans every time that we saw her. So a hypertensive emergency is that you've shown end organ damage. Urgency is, and I would argue this point, asymptomatic elevation of blood pressure more than 180. Non-dipper, that's an important concept because most people dip their blood pressure when they go to bed. People with chronic hypertension and CKD don't dip. And if you restore dipping by changing the dosing of your blood pressure medicines to nocturnal, you can actually improve outcomes. Gestational hypertension is pressure more than 140 over 90 that occurs prior to week 20. So eclampsia and preeclampsia occurs after week 20. So this is the data that talks about, so this has been the NHANES data that has looked at how often are you aware you have hypertension? Are you on treatment for your hypertension? Are you controlled for your hypertension? So if you look at this and this goes from 2000 up to 2012. And if we look at the data from 2012 to onward, it's going to look similar to this. So over time, we've gotten better. More people that have hypertension know they have hypertension. More people that have hypertension are treated for hypertension. More people that have hypertension are treated and controlled. But you still see a splay between awareness and control. Okay, a splay between awareness and control. So this has been true. But if you looked at cardiovascular mortality, you'd actually see during this period of time it's dropped. So despite the fact we don't do a perfect job, we're doing a pretty good thing. We're actually improving outcomes. So what are the benefits? Well, you can decrease stroke incidence by 35 to 40%. You can decrease MIs. You can treat, and the biggest bang for your buck is decrease heart failure. The most common risk factor for heart failure is hypertension. So what do you do when you see a hypertensive patient? Well, it's pretty much its usual history and physical as long as some directed tests. So you do your typical history and physical on them, you examine them. I always take blood pressures in three extremities because I want to know, I especially want to know whether there's a difference between my arms. I'll check the lower extremity because I want to see if there's a drop-off, that they could have some kind of weird thing like coarctation. We look in their eyes, we examine their heart, we look for all those things. And then we do some directed lab tests. And they're pretty benign, limited stuff. So you do a sugar, you do a blood count, you do lipids. You want to know what the GFR is. You want to know what the serum, potassium, calcium is, and sodium. They recommend a TSH. They recommend a urinalysis. And everybody, they recommend an EKG, which is a totally worthless test. And if you come to my office, because I'm a nephrologist, I look at a urine albumin to creatinine ratio. Because a urine albumin to creatinine ratio is an easy test to do, and it gives me lots of information about end organ disease. So I always check blood pressures on two arms because simply having hypertension and then showing more than a 10 millimeter difference between the two sides, that increases mortality. So by definition, that's a high-risk patient, and I should be more aggressive in workup and follow-up of those patients. So I always check two arms. And I always take the highest of the two, right? We're all trained to take the highest of the two because that's the truest blood pressure you're going to get. And how hard is that? That's really so easy to do. Ambulatory blood pressure monitoring is done for people that it's paid for, unfortunately. So who is it paid for? It's paid for those people that you think have white coat hypertension, and it's paid for those people that have mass hypertension. It'd be nice if we just put people on medications and did ambulatory blood pressure monitoring to see if we've accomplished goal. But instead, what we typically do is we usually will have them self-measure blood pressure. So pretty much every one of my patients that I can get to do it will self-measure their blood pressure. And their self-measurement of blood pressure is better than my office blood pressure for predicting outcomes, right? So if I get a pressure of 150 and they tell me their pressure's been 120 to 130 at home, they're right, I'm wrong, okay? So they're going to do better than I expect based on my office blood pressure. So home blood pressures are better than my office blood pressures. So this is from the new ACC guidelines, and they're talking about resistant hypertension. So remember, resistant hypertension is on three drugs, one of them a diuretic, blood pressure above goal, or on four drugs. And they say, what are the reasons for resistance? And some of the reasons can be that I'm not checking the blood pressure right, or they're not checking the blood pressure rate. So one of the things that happens with my patients is I ask them to get a blood pressure cuff. I usually give them a brand. I'll say get an Omron. They're very cheap, inexpensive. You can buy it on Amazon. And what they do is they get none of my patients are usual adults. They're all large adults. And they'll get a usual adult cuff. So the usual adult cuff will falsely say that their blood pressure is high. A lot of my patients have a difficult time following a salt-restricted diet. A big thing when I see patients in the office and their blood pressure is above goal, they're like a good percentage of those people, if I check their ankles, have edema. So getting rid of edema is one of the first things you go towards blood pressure, because anybody that has hypertension and edema, part of the hypertension is salt sensitive. Maybe I don't give them the right drugs, maybe they're taking something else. So that's my usual blood pressure patients. And then what about secondary hypertension? So we're going to go through a few isolated causes of secondary hypertension. So Who do we screen? So these are people that have new onset. So they never were hypertensive before, then suddenly they're hypertensive. Or they're drug resistant, so that's the resistant hypertension. Or they are wrong age, they're less than 30, and this is their, then they're hypertensive. Or their blood pressure was always controlled before, and now it's not controlled anymore. Or they present with malignant hypertension. If you present with malignant hypertension, the incidence of secondary hypertension is extremely high. Or they have sort of unprovoked, or so when you do that screening test, their potassium is 3.2. That suggests that maybe they have a secondary cause. So then they recommend that you screen them, and we'll talk a little bit about which ones. So the first thing is the relationship between, this is the most common reason for secondary hypertension. So this is the most common reason for secondary hypertension is CKD. This graph shows you as your GFR gets worse, your blood pressure gets higher. And what's the incidence of hypertension by the time my patients hit dialysis? At least 75 to 85% of my patients are hypertensive. So the worse the kidney function, the higher the blood pressure. And if you look at all the other things that are associated with hypertension, like anemia, inability to walk, the hypocalcemia, high serum phosphorus, hypertension by far and away is that lavender bar, and by far and away, no matter what their GFR is, it's the most common complication of CKD. So they have salt-sensitive hypertension. And again, like I said, you always have to so if their GFR is less than 60, they have to be on some type of diuretic, okay? So GFR less than 60, they have to be on some type of diuretic. And then why does it matter? Well, this is why it matters. So if you don't treat blood pressure, their kidneys progressively decline, okay? So if they have CKD and you don't treat blood pressure, their kidneys, you lose kidney function more than 5% per year. But yet if you control their blood pressure, you can get that down to 1 ml per year. So control of blood pressure in all CKD patients matters, okay? So part of the reason that we're so aggressive about blood pressure control in my patients is that we want to save kidneys, all right? And when this is just quick things from ACEs and ARBs, and how effective is it in chronic kidney disease? And we'll use our most common type of kidney disease to look at first. This is the DCCT trial, which was really tight control of type 1 diabetes. And these are captopril, this is ibisartan, and this is losartan. And if you look at this, the one that I really care about the most is this one here. These, I'm colorblind, so the non-yellow type of thing is number needed to treat, okay? So if you have a number needed to treat of 10 or less, with something like an angiotensin receptor blocker to save one kidney, that's a lot of bang for your buck. That's a lot of bang for your buck. So if they, in diabetics, if you use ACEs and ARBs, you get a lot of bang for your buck for the use of ACEs and ARBs used to save one kidney. And you don't have to treat that many people to get it. Okay, and the second thing is the worse they are, the more bang for your buck. So the worse the proteinuria is, the better they do. So the worse your, and then if you look at trials, and they look at stage 3 and stage 4 chronic kidney disease, the number needed to treat drops with each stage. So in stage 3 chronic kidney disease, number needed to treat is 10 to 11, but if you go to stage 4 chronic kidney disease, it's only 5. And especially if you have high amounts of proteinuria. So the worse the patient with GFR, the worse the proteinuria, the more bang for your buck that you get. So we don't have a GFR that we say is a contraindication to the use of ACEs and ARBs in our diabetics. There's none. And we even have data to suggest that even in our patients that are on dialysis that still have residual renal function, the kidneys will stick around longer if we have them on an ACE or an ARB. And this is just to remind you that if you're going to put people with CKD on an ACE or an ARB, you have to kind of recheck labs in a little bit of time, depending on how bad their GFR is. If their GFR sucks, then you probably ought to do it pretty soon, within a couple weeks. If their GFR isn't too bad, you can wait for six to 8 weeks before you recheck. And what do you look for? You look for more than a 30% rise in creatinine or potassium more than 5.5. So if your potassium is less than 5.5 and your creatinine hasn't increased by more than 30%, then you're successful. You can titrate upward if you need to. Okay. Renovascular hypertension. So this used to be a pretty common topic. I can remember that we used to always talk about this as making the diagnosis, and everybody knew the path, and everybody knew who the patient was that got this, but it sort of has changed a little bit. So this is the stuff we always know about. So if you have somebody that had hypertension at age less than 25 or more than 55, if you could hear a brewery, if you have refractory hypertension, then you have to think of renal vascular disease. If you have a unilateral small kidney, or if you have flash pulmonary edema. And so we came up with non-invasive testing to try to find it. And you can see most of the time we do duplexes, but you can also do CT angios and magnetic MRAs, and you could diagnose it with pretty good sensitivity and specificity. But why it really came to our attention is because our damn cardiologists kept used to stick catheters in the renal arteries on the way up to do a cath. So they would go to do a cath, and they'd say, oh, there's nothing there. Let me see if I can find something to do. And they would pull out, and they'd shoot the renal arteries, and the renal arteries might have stenosis, might not have stenosis. They'd come out, and they'd say, we fixed it. And we'd say, you fixed what? We fixed the renal artery stenosis, but they don't have hypertension. Why did you fix it? What's the reason for fixing it? And so what happened was CMS noticed that we went from 1996, 7,500 procedures to 35,000 procedures in 2005, and they said, we're going to do a trial. And the trial was called the CORAL trial, and it was sponsored by CMS. And what they wanted to know is they wanted to know whether aggressive medical therapy versus intervention, whether there was difference in outcomes. So here's how good they were. Remember I showed you the stuff about awareness and treatment and control? These people that they saw, if you were not a diabetic, 93% of those people met control criteria, okay? So pretty damn good. Even in diabetics, they were 80%. So this was good medical therapy. And then they compared that to stent, and look, there's no difference. So this trial came out in 2014, and literally that huge amount of people that were getting angioplasties is virtually down to nothing. So nowadays, the only time we do angioplasties in our patients, and the other thing to refresh your memory is, look at this. These are people that we have on ACEs that have renal vascular disease. They do a lot better. So you should treat them medically. They should be on an ACE. And the reason, at the end of the day, the only reasons we do angioplasty are people that have recurrent flash pulmonary edema, refractory hypertension, which is almost never, right? There's virtually nobody you can't control with modern therapy, and those people that have progressive renal disease with what we know are severe renal vascular disease we might intervene in. So we've sort of dropped that down. We don't treat just hypertension anymore for this. Cool. Primary aldosteronism. So that's another common cause of secondary hypertension. How common is it? Well, so here's resistant hypertension, right? So resistant hypertension, we all know the definition now. And they took people that were unselected, so they didn't really try to diagnose them at all yet. But all they did was they just put them on spironolactone. And then they looked at them at 6 weeks and 3 months, and they looked at 6 months. And this is the difference in systolic blood pressure in these patients. Do you know any other drug that decreases systolic blood pressure like this? I don't. None of the drugs I use are that successful. So there's a 20 to 25 millimeter decrease in systolic blood pressure simply by using spironolactone. So it sort of gives you a little bit of a clue. Number one, spironolactone is a very effective drug for people that have resistant hypertension. And number two, maybe a large percent of these people have primary hyperaldosteronism. And so when they've looked at people that have resistant hypertension, about one in five do. Right, so if you have, so we don't work everybody up with this, but if you have hypokalemia, maybe we'll work them up for it. Now, knowing full well that half the people that have primary aldosteronism don't have hypokalemia, and if you have resistant hypertension, then it's probably worthwhile to work them up because one in five have primary aldosteronism, and you have very effective treatments for this. And the worse the blood pressure, the more likely you are to have this disease. Okay. And the way we diagnose this, we just basically we'll do a PRA, which is we send a serum plasma, we'll do a plasma renin and we'll do an aldosterone and we'll set up a ratio. And if the ratio is more than 30 to 1, and especially if the serum aldosterone level is more than 20, likely this is the disease. Now, if they're young, we look for adenomas. If they're over age 40, we don't look for adenomas because it's hard to show that taking adenomas out actually make people's blood pressure better. We just treat them with spironolactone. So that's our approach. And the problem is that many of these people are hyperplastic and not adenomatous. Okay. So why do we treat? We treat because this is the most important stroke risk factor. But I think the thing to me that puts it into perspective is look how many people we have to treat to save one stroke. 7,937. So I showed you numbers like number needed to treat of 10 in CKD patients saving a kidney. We got to treat an awful lot of people to save one stroke. But on the other hand, nobody argues about statins, right? Nobody argues about aspirin. Nobody argues about ACE. Now, secondary prevention makes me feel a little bit better. So if you've had a stroke or you're high risk for stroke, we only have to treat 50 people to prevent one stroke. So it is a worthwhile thing to do. All right, so this is sort of the new classification and approach to hypertension. So I just want to point out maybe just two parts of this. So first part is that if you have this elevated blood pressure, what they recommend is you get lifestyle modification and follow-up. So these are people they think might have hypertension, might not. Now, in major data, if you look at diagnosis of hypertension, about one-third of the people you thought had hypertension don't at the end of 1 year, and one-third of the people you thought didn't have hypertension at the end of the year. So this is just, you identify this, we tell people to do lifestyle modification, which is kind of warm and fuzzy, and we bring them back. Then the next thing they do is if you have true hypertension, if it's more than 140, you get drug therapy. If it's 130 or greater, you get drug therapy if you have high cardiovascular risk. So what's changed a little bit about our control, our approach to hypertension is we want to answer two questions when we do it. One is your blood pressure, how high is it? And secondly, if we do a risk profile, are you high risk for cardiovascular disease, okay? Because if you're high risk for cardiovascular disease, we're gonna have a lower threshold for drug therapy. And so what's the non-pharmacologic things we can do to make you feel warm and fuzzy? So you can see that all these things have some effect. Weight loss, healthy diet, reduced intake of dietary sodium, the DASH diet, elevated potassium in your diet, they all have some effect, and that's sort of warm and fuzzy and makes you feel better. And you can tell people to move more, and you can tell them don't drink so much. But the problem has been durability. So they get great responses, but it's not very durable. So I think this is certainly something I try to instruct my patients on and I try to emphasize, but I realize that it's not a very durable thing. If they can continue it, it works, but if they can't continue it, then we have a lot of trouble. And if you look, this is the number of blood pressure medicines it takes to control an average hypertensive. So if you have a person that has hypertension, they're gonna be on between the average number, it's gonna be beyond between 2 and 3 meds. So the fact that they're on, when my patients say, I'm on 2 medicines for my blood pressure, I can't believe it, or I'm on 3 medicines for my blood pressure, they're average. They're not much different than the rest of my people. So just quickly, we'll talk about changes. We have all of 5 minutes, so that's good. So we're well within the, you guys all followed hypertension? How many new guidelines have come out for hypertension in the past 5 years? So there's the JNC8, which we were all waiting for. There's the European Heart. Then there's the American Society of Nephrology and the American Society of Hypertension guidelines. And then there's the ACC guidelines. So there's at least 4 different guidelines or 5 different guidelines that have come out. And if you look at them, they all have different recommendations, and they confuse the hell out of me, if you want to know the truth. So if your patient is more than 70 and they have a low cardiovascular risk, then I can make their pressure 150. Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense. So the only saving grace I can tell you is that we have very simplified guidelines now, and part of that is, in fact, because it's cardiologists that made it, and cardiologists like simple things. And part of it's because they didn't care if they had evidence, we're just gonna tell you what to make it. So what happened was the JNC8 guidelines came out first, and this was a group of hypertension specialists and nephrologists that said, if there's not enough evidence to recommend it, we're not going to recommend it. So hence, in certain age groups, like if you're less than 40 years old or if you're an older person, we don't have evidence to show that making your pressure normal is going to help you, right? And they also did this before the SPRINT trial, and I'm going to show you the SPRINT trial real quick. So the only thing they came out with is, they came out with the same group of drugs that they all do. We calcium channel blocker, thiazides, ACE or ARB as first line therapy. We all agree on that. That's good. They use beta blockers and aldosterone for people that it would fail. African-Americans should be on thiazide diuretics first because they typically have low renin hypertension. Don't use ACE and ARB. Everybody agrees on that. And then they recommended that ACE inhibitors for all CKD patients, which, and then the American Society of Nephrology said, well, for proteinuria, yes, but not for everybody else. And then they came up with these recommendations. And can you remember this or follow this? I can't remember this or follow this. It drives me crazy. Now, the good news is they were really scientific about this. And the reason they did this is because they said we don't have evidence. So if we have evidence, we'll tell you, but we don't have evidence, so we're not going to recommend it. So then the SPRINT trial came out. So the SPRINT trial came out after this, and what this did was it took a lot of people, and to get into this, you had to be hypertensive, and you had to have high cardiovascular risk, moderate to high cardiovascular risk. So if they put you into the Framingham risk score or the ACC risk score, you had to have more than 10% risk for cardiovascular events at 1 year. So hypertension, high cardiovascular risk. And who did they take? They took virtually everybody except for diabetics, right? And except for people that had severe renal failure. So you could be old and be in this, you could be white and be in this, you could be black and be in this, you could be young and be in this. So they took everybody, but it's non-diabetics. And they said, we think that if we make your pressure less than 120, we're gonna improve cardiovascular events. And that's what they thought. So that's what they showed. They showed that less than 120 resulted in a decrease in all-cause mortality, a decrease in the primary outcome, which is MACE, so it's MI, acute coronary syndrome, CVA, and heart failure. It also caused a decrease in death from all causes. So lo and behold, the SPRINT trial is now looking at all these different patients across all the age groups and sexes and all the race groups, and they said everybody did better when we made their pressure better. So here's the outcomes that they looked at. And you can see that standard treatment versus intensive treatment won out on all of them. And then if you looked at the various populations, whether it be age, whether it be sex, whether it be race, whether it be presence or absence of CKD, they all did better. So in their 9,000 patients, pressures of 120 or less did better. Now remember who those 9,000 patients were. They were moderate to high cardiovascular risk. And not one of them was diabetic, okay? So not one of them was diabetic. They also showed that you had some side effects of doing this. They're more likely to become hypotensive. That's not surprising, right? They're more likely to have acute kidney injury, and they're more likely to have ER visits. So then the ACC guidelines came out. And the ACC guidelines, if you look at the authors of the ACC guidelines, it wouldn't surprise you that many of the authors were from the SPRINT trial. So they obviously had an iron in the fire. And the ACC guidelines said, we're gonna come up with guidelines based on the SPRINT trial and we're gonna make recommendations. And so first they're gonna say, we're gonna have a different classification. So you're gonna have normal blood pressure, we're gonna have elevated blood pressure, we're gonna have stage one and stage two hypertension, pretty similar to what they were before. And then they're gonna say, we're gonna take populations of treatment. And I'll give you a summary slide and that's gonna be the best thing. So one, there's a threshold for treatment, which is almost always gonna be greater than 130, except in those people that really are low risk, so they have low cardiovascular risk and they're relatively young, then the threshold for drug therapy is more than 140. And then their goals for therapy are 130, 130, 130, 130, 130, 130. So it's a little bit easier, right? I can remember 130. So sometimes the 130 makes sense because it's substantiated by the SPRINT trial. Sometimes it doesn't make sense. So they didn't have diabetics. So what's my recommendations for diabetics? And they really didn't look at young, low-risk people. So what's my recommendations for that? And I think basically they said, well, 130 must be good for everybody. So right now, our recommendations are assess cardiovascular risk and shoot for 130. or don't assess cardiovascular risk and shoot for 130. So that's really where we are with hypertension control right now, according to the guidelines. And for my job, it makes it easier for me. Now, I was hoping to look and see that my kidney patients did better as far as their kidney function, because there was a fair amount of people with CKD in this. And we didn't show improvement in renal outcomes, but they lived longer. So they were less likely to have cardiovascular events, which is why my patients usually die cardiovascular death. So that's where we are, I think, with that. And let's see, anything else? So when it comes to guidelines, we shouldn't, if we don't think too good, we shouldn't think too much. So that makes it easier for me at 130, 130, 130. So I have some slides on nephrolithiasis, which make no sense for hypertension, but apparently that's a hole that we haven't hit. So I'll give you the quick and dirty nephrolithiasis. So one, it's pretty frequent. So male versus female, male are sort of twice as likely to have hypertension. If you have one, your relapse rate is 35 to 50% within 5 years. So when your patients come to you with their first event, they have almost a 50% risk of recurrent stones within 5 years. And so the questions they ask is, what can we do about it? Well, there's some genetic things, but there are also dietary things that we think make a difference. So some of the risk factors are low fluid intake, low calcium intake. You know, isn't that crazy? Because we used to tell people that you had to be on a low calcium diet if you had stones, but low calcium intake increases the risk, and high fructose intake. So that's things like sodas with fructose as their sweetener. So the workup that we have, and it's really kind of hard to show that this workup matters except for the uric acid in the urine and the uric acid in the serum, is we look at things that cause, that lead to stones, and we try to address them. So if we address them, what do we get? So the first thing we know is if we give fluid intake more than 2 liters a day, that decreases the incidence of stones. We think that if you abstain from soft drinks, especially dark soft drinks, that'll decrease the incidence of stone. We want you to be on a pretty normal diet, but low sodium, okay? So low sodium, low animal protein if possible, those things seem to decrease the incidence of stone. And then pharmacologically, we have things. If you're hypercalciuric and we put you on the thiazide, we can decrease the incidence of stone. Look at the number needed to treat on that one, 3. So I only have to repeat. So stones are actually very easy to treat, and they're very rewarding to treat, and they're very cheap to treat. Citrate will decrease the number, will decrease calcium stones. The number needed to treat is 3. And then allopurinol, if you have hyperuricosuria, if you treat them, you only have to treat 5 people to decrease the incidence. So that's pretty much stones, okay? So stones are frequent. They tend to be recurrent. There's some dietary things you can do for them. The dietary data is not as good as the pharmacologic data. The pharmacologic data is pretty damn cheap things that give you a lot of bang for your buck. So they actually can be a very rewarding thing.